Welcome back to the Leading Edge of Integrative Mental Health. I'm your host, Lisa Dale Miller. Please review and subscribe to the Groundless Ground podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Radio.com, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, and of course, find out more at groundlessground.com. I'm ready to go. How about you? Eric Garland is a rare combination of rigorous researcher and compassionate clinician. His unique integration of CBT and mindfulness led him to create Mindfulness-Oriented Recovery Enhancement, or what is known as MORE, an integrative group intervention for treating chronic pain, stress, and opioid misuse. His attention to detail and methodology has made Eric a trusted researcher. In 2019, he was appointed to the NIH HEAL Multidisciplinary Working Group to help guide the HEAL initiative on pain and addiction. Our dialogue was exciting for both of us. We really share a sense that helping patients attend to both savoring and insight is key to helping them move beyond the murky grasp of addiction. I know you're going to enjoy our lively conversation. Eric Garland, this is a true pleasure to have you here. We can talk about all kinds of interesting clinical issues as well as research issues, treatment of chronic pain, opioid use, particular mindfulness intervention that you've been using. Thank you so much for being on.
My pleasure.
You're really interesting. I don't know how you have time to do all the things your bio says you currently are doing.
Me neither.
You're a wonderful combination of a really serious researcher, and you're also a clinician. You're a social worker. Do you still have private practice?
Yep, a little bit.
I'd love to hear about some of the organizations that you appear to be very involved in. For instance, the Academic Consortium on Integrative Medicine and also the HEAL Initiative. If you could just start by giving people a sense of how a clinician like you has managed to be so involved on the research side.
My clinical work really has informed my science. The majority of the therapeutic processes that I study, that really emerged out of clinical work with patients. My clinical work was sort of my living laboratory where I would, in part, generate ideas for things to study scientifically and then move that into the lab and study those therapeutic processes using gold standard clinical science methodologies as well as neuroscience. And then I back translate that into clinical work, taking what I've learned from the science and moving it back into actual work with patients in need.
I'm always stunned at how academics who do research don't really have any sense of what those of us who are clinicians experience directly in the room every day.
True. There is some of that.
Do you ever get frustrated when you are interfacing with some of your colleagues who are not clinicians?
There's certainly a number of folks. They're actually doing intervention research, but they are not clinicians. It's an interesting combination. They can be experts and are experts in research methodology. If you don't really know what it's like to work with the person on the ground, you may be missing some insights.
Like?
You know, the original conceptualization of mindfulness that dominated the emergence of our field was really Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness as being this non-judgmental, ostensibly non-cognitive kind of process, merely being aware of and accepting one's experience. But what I noticed early on in doing mindfulness training with my clients, and this was before combining mindfulness with psychotherapy was so in vogue. And back in those days, what I observed was that I would teach people this ostensibly non-cognitive, non-discursive, non-judgmental practice of being mindful of the breath, for example. What emerged out of that was this highly cognitive, highly judgmental, meaning-based process of people coming to see their life from a different perspective. You know, I wanted to understand that. Fortunately, there were pretty good social psychology models that existed at the time of understanding how people come to make appraisals of the meaning of what they're facing in their life. And so I came up with this early hypothesis that I called the mindful reappraisal hypothesis, which is pretty simple. It just says that the non-judgmental, non-cognitive process of mindfulness promotes the ability to reappraise the meaning of one's life from a different perspective and to see life adversity as a source of growth and purpose and meaningfulness. And so when I brought this to my colleagues in the mindfulness field, nearly universally, they were horrified by the idea.
Really?
and utterly rejected it. The rejections were really on the basis of, I think, again, this early emerging model of what mindfulness was. On top of that, one particular dogmatic approach, I think, to Theravada Buddhism and its take on mindfulness. And sort of the combination of what the emerging scientific dogma of this is what mindfulness is, plus this one mm-hmm. Buddhist take, they completely rejected it. I didn't make this up. They're telling me, hey, I did this mindfulness and now I can see my life from a different perspective. And there's this meaning in my life. That went on to be an interesting tension in the mindfulness field between myself and some of my most beloved colleagues. It isn't even over yet. It continues, but I think there's enough data to have amassed now to support the fact that my hypothesis was correct. But I think that's just one example of how there are clinical insights that emerge that don't necessarily map on to the standard research framework that you might miss if you're not a clinician. The other one I'll mention now that I'm on this roll is the other piece, which mm-hmm. was savoring.
I'm so glad we're going to talk about this. I have a parallel story. So in 2004, when I was doing my 3,000 clinical hours to become an LMFT, I was trained in DBT, and I had a group, and Marsh Linehan had told me back then that borderlines can't meditate, and neither can schizophrenics.
And that's why there was no meditation in the original DBT, right?
I created an 8-week DBT curricula that included Qigong and mindfulness of breath meditation, along with the DBT skills. And this was a group for schizophrenics and people with severe psychosis. So we would do 45 minutes, and then there was a 15-minute Qigong break, where we would do Qigong for 15 minutes. And nobody was doing anything like this back then. And they all learned to meditate, and they loved meditation. It was great. Every time I would end an 8-week series, and I would go around the group and I would say, what was your favorite thing? Inevitably, none of them could remember any of the DBT anagrams or anything like that. But their favorite thing, hands down, was always Qigong. And savoring, when I used to give MBRP groups many years ago, I actually, after the raisin, I would send around a thing of M&Ms so they could really get craving, so they could really see the difference.
The mindful savoring hypothesis states that mindfulness facilitates the ability to savor.
Absolutely.
Natural, healthy pleasure, joy, and meaning in life. And I can tell you the reaction that I got to that idea was probably even more violent than the reaction I got to the mindful reappraisal idea. And I'm not going to name names. Under the quote mantle of Buddhism, I was literally told by somebody, focusing on the positive is just as bad as focusing on the negative. I thought, these are the kinds of mentalities that are existing in the field, then I need to just do my own thing. And so I created my own form of psychotherapy called mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement that integrates these two theoretical principles of using mindfulness to synergize reappraisal, to synergize savoring. And it turns out, particularly with savoring, that is unbelievably clinically important.
I agree. And also, whoever told you that about the Buddhist teachings is not accurate, because the historical Buddha and later the Amidharma, wholesome states of mind was something that the Sangha and the monks were cultivating specifically.
Yes.
They were cultivating it in their daily life, but they were also cultivating it through jhana practice. Frankly, jhana practice is all about cultivating these refined, wholesome states of mind.
Including bliss.
Ananda is so important.
As the tradition moved into places like Tibet, for example, as it integrated with the tantric practice, flowering into Mahamudra and Dzogchen, you have cultivation of bliss and positive mental states as a soteriological final pathway, because the true nature of mind is not neutral. The true nature of mind has a positive tone.
The union of emptiness and clarity,
yes,
which is the nature of mind mm-hmm. in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra teachings, that union in and of itself, it is qualityless. It has no quality. But when anything is manifested from that, that is the compassionate impulse, which is ultimately positivity, because there is no separation between any of those three qualities. One could say that the nature of mind has bliss, or as the yogic tradition would say, Satchitananda. Okay, so we've established that you and I are on the same page completely.
Yeah. But coming to the data, right, and what the data seems to say is that savoring is incredibly powerful from a clinical perspective. Its effects on clinical outcomes as well as effects on the brain. And we're only beginning to learn about that.
So tell me, which did you become interested in first? Treating chronic pain or the addiction cycle that can often accompany chronic pain patients in their need to try to find some kind of relief?
A lot of my early clinical work was in integrative medicine settings. So I worked alongside physicians and nurses, acupuncturists, what have you, and I was the head shrinker. I was the mind-body guy. And a lot of that work was done in people with pain and other psychosomatic conditions. But at the exact same time in my research work, I was focusing on addiction. I did my dissertation, which was funded by the Mind and Life Institute of Rella Grant, the first study of Moore as a treatment for alcoholism in people in inner city Durham, North Carolina treatment facility. When I got my first faculty position, I was looking to start a new line of research. I had just shown up to Florida and a physician colleague of mine got to know me and he said, "Hey, wait, you do work on mindfulness for pain and you're studying addiction? In Florida here, it's 2010 and we're the pain pill mill capital of the USA. You ought to study mindfulness for pain and an opioid addiction." And the light bulb kind of went off. "Come on down to the clinic." And so there you go. There's my past decade of my life.
Wow, that is so great.
So I modified the treatment, mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement, to integrate pain management in addition to the addiction techniques that were built in. And then I tested it in the first pilot randomized controlled trial that was in Florida, 115 people. They were randomly assigned to 8 weeks of Moore or 8 weeks of a social support group led by a therapist. That study was the springboard for all the research that has followed.
Well, why don't we talk about Moore?
Sure.
It's really different.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah. Because sometimes it's been called a sort of a derivative of MBSR, and it certainly was heavily informed by MBSR and MBCT, but I don't think it's a derivative though.
You know, I was thinking about MBRP.
And Sarah and I, we sat on a cliff outside of the Garrison Monastery at the Garrison and talked about Moore in 2007 when I was just starting to dream it up. Mm-hmm. I was indebted to Sarah Bowen for that.
She's so amazing. She and Neha, they are really amazing human beings. And MBRP is very beautiful, but I feel like MBRP is much more aligned with MBSR and MBCT than Moore. And that's
correct.
What I like about Moore, because I feel like you've systematized something I actually teach my patients, which I call mindful drinking. I didn't write this in my textbook. This is something I just give my patients. When they come to me and they say, "You know, I'm not sure what I want to do about this, but I think I have to change what's happening with my drinking." And they're not sure whether or not they have to stop or whether they can moderate. So I give them a way to be so fully in the experience of it and not just monitor the taste, but monitor what's happening in their psyche, what's happening in their body, how much it actually takes to get that little bit of relaxation that they're probably seeking anyway. Once they've got that, if they take any more of the substance, does it go away? What does it turn into? And you know, pretty much after a few weeks of doing this, they're not really interested that much in the substance anymore.
Cool. That is an interesting parallel. So I've studied more for a wide range of addiction. And I've studied it in a context of people who are already in treatment and are abstaining from drugs. The opioid work has all been with people who are currently taking prescription opioids every day. You're right. That's an interesting parallel with your own work. One of the key processes is having people develop mindful awareness of their opioid use as they do it.
Presence.
Yeah.
What's it actually like?
Right.
Don't get lost.
Even before that is what happens as you are preparing to take the opioid. Be mindful when you approach and you have this intention to take this pill. Start to explore that whole process from the moment that your mouth begins to fill with saliva, like Pavlov's dogs, when you pull that pill out of the bottle. And by the way, we just finished a study on this that hasn't been published yet. And in fact, opioid users do salivate when they take that pill out. We measured the amount of saliva produced. And not only do they exhibit a conditioned salivary response, but mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement can decrease the conditioned salivary response, which is pretty insane. I would say that the effects on reduction of drug cue reactivity, which I've shown in multiple ways with multiple measures, whether it's, you know, using an attentional bias measure of performance-based measure of attention, or whether it's looking at heart rate variability or EEG response. I've shown that mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement decreases the brain's reactivity to presence of the drug-related cue. I think a lot of that is attributed to straight mindfulness meditation. There's a key hypothesis that I have that I call the restructuring reward hypothesis. Increasing sensitization to natural pleasure will reverse the addictive process. So it will shift the person's valuing of the drug-related reward back to valuing the natural healthy rewards in their life, and that will reduce craving and addictive behavior. And so savoring does feed into this, because mindful savoring is one of the key tools that we use in more to restructure the reward process in the brain. And we talked about this sort of out of order. When I usually talk about this, I talk about addiction neuroscience models. And so the most prominent addiction neuroscience models state that as the person becomes more and more addicted, there are changes that occur in the brain, in the brain's reward system, that have two key effects. The brain becomes increasingly sensitive to stress, pain, and drug-related cues. Secondly, the brain becomes insensitive to the natural pleasure derived from healthy objects and events in the social environment. So the person is less able to experience a healthy sense of joy, and therefore they feel like crap. They're in a hole of despair. They take higher and higher doses of the drug just to feel okay. But of course, that feeling okay is an ever-dwindling process, right? Because they can never feel quite as okay, and they get even more and more blunted to natural pleasure. So they take higher and higher doses of the drug, and it's these diminishing returns. So the person gets trapped in a downward spiral. And of course, we also know that chronic pain magnifies this process and further blunts responsivity to natural reward. My idea is pretty simple. Just reverse it then. Use mindfulness, teach people how to savor the good in their lives, how to reclaim a sense of healthy pleasure, joy, and meaning, using the enhanced cognitive capacities that mindfulness gives us, the enhanced attentional control, the enhanced cognitive control, the enhanced metacognitive awareness, the enhanced sensory perceptual contact. Using that enhanced cognitive function, we can then boost the ability to savor the good in our lives. And that will then, in the case of somebody who's developed an addiction or they've become dependent on opioids as a way of coping with chronic pain, that will help them to reclaim that sense of pleasure, joy, and meaning from everyday healthful objects and experiences in everyday life. A beautiful sunset, the spring flowers coming up, holding hands with somebody they care about, or looking at somebody smiling. And the more joy they feel from that, the less they're going to need it from the drug. It looks like the data is supporting this idea.
So what I'm hearing you emphasize is relapse prevention therapy emphasized in a less useful way, which was
the original. Marla pretty much said you need to teach people how to get high in other ways, right?
Yes. So now I'm going to ask you some questions regarding the outcomes of more. I did hear you say, well, I think a lot of this is because of the mindfulness meditation. How many different forms of meditative practice do you teach through that 10 sessions?
In the opioid application, it's now an 8-session treatment. I think it's going to be 8-session for the straight addiction applications as well.
How many practices are you actually giving them?
Mindful breathing, body scan. We teach informal mindfulness practice, mindful reappraisal, mindful savoring, a visualization practice that really involves visualizing the flow of energy in the body, not unlike a Taoist or tantric practice.
Okay.
There's mindfulness of craving, the mindful chocolate exercise. And then there's a meditation on interdependence, a future visualization exercise in the final session. It's not very clean from a research standpoint because there's lots of different techniques going on, and who knows what any one of those practices does in isolation.
That was my first question. But just to get a little more refined, when they're going through the 8 weeks, do you have them fill out a practice chart so you know how much practice they're actually doing?
Yes, we're using smartphones to get daily logs of minutes of practice logged. And with my latest study, we're going to be able to examine this in the most fine-grained way that we ever have yet, including we're going to use some pretty advanced causal modeling techniques to try to see, you know, if you practice 10 minutes today, how does it affect how you feel tomorrow?
Also, what you practice.
The differential efficacy of the, of these techniques, examine those simultaneously in regression models, and should be pretty interesting.
So this is very satisfying for me, because this is the thing that I've been feeling for all these years has been missing from all these interventions. Because as you know, people will not practice that much. They will practice something they enjoy.
That's true. And actually, speaking of that, everything that we do in MORE is just a little bit different. So for example, even in mindful breathing, which is somewhat straight up mindful breathing, at the very end, we throw in a little bit of savoring. We say, now you've been meditating for 15 minutes. Now we want you to focus on the best parts of this experience, savoring and appreciating any positive mental states that have arisen during this practice. Or you can continue to focus on the breath.
With the chronic pain patients, are you having them do any kind of resting in the sensations they're having themselves rather than the narrative, which they think is the pain, but is not actually the pain?
Yes, this has been a key process from day one in this work, is that mindfulness of the breath is undoubtedly analgesic in the acute laboratory pain induction paradigm that my colleague and friend Fadel Zeidan has studied extensively. There's no doubt about it. That's powerfully analgesic. And I've studied it clinically in people with all sorts of pain conditions. And we find that it also works. But I think when you treat chronic pain, in my opinion, as a clinician, I think there's value in doing something different, which is teaching people to face their pain directly. Peer right into the heart of the pain, see it for what it is. What we do in mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement is once they've built sort of a stable platform of mindfulness, so attention is now focused, attention is stable, the mind has become more open, less reactive. So that takes about 5 minutes or so. Then the person turns their attention inward into the pain sensation, and we ask them to notice, you have pain, what is it really? Perhaps it's sensations of tightness or heat or tingling. And then we ask them to introspect and break down the experience of pain into its sensory components. And then we ask them to notice, do the sensations have a center? Do they have edges? Are there spaces inside the sensation where the sensation is not? All the work that I've done for 10 years and listening to hour after hour of tapes of patients reporting their experience during this meditation, that's where the true magic happens. Is when they look for the edges in the center and the spaces. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, I thought you were crazy. I didn't want to look at my pain at all. I looked at my pain and you asked me if it had an edge, and I looked for the edge and I couldn't really find an edge. The edge was kind of fuzzy. So I focused on the fuzziness. The next thing I know, I couldn't find my pain. My pain was gone. You know, these are people who are coming in and saying their pain is a 6, is a 7, is an 8 out of 10 every day. And I've heard that story time and time again. And the other thing people notice when they do this, not everybody, but a lot of people, is they sometimes even notice pleasure inside of the pain.
Of course. And part of that is the belief that comes from when the story is not going, the tissues and the muscles can actually relax. And when bracing in the structure falls away, most of what people call chronic pain falls away, because most of it is resistance. And we know this, certainly from the Buddhist teachings. Aversion is what most people hate, not displeasurable experience itself.
Right. And so you could give an interpretation of this from particularly the Tibetan texts and then also from the tantric tradition. You'll just find statements that the true nature of any experience is the unity of bliss and awareness. And so you're finding in the heart of any of these experiences, the primordial nature of consciousness, which is bliss. That'd be one interpretation. You could give a neural interpretation. You could hypothesize that during this state that there's activation in the reward system of the brain. And, you know, whether it's mediated by endogenous opioids or endocannabinoids or the GABA system or dopamine or serotonin, we don't know yet. But regardless, we have people with chronic pain try to get beneath the story. I'm really excited about this because, as you probably know, in the mindfulness field, there are so few replications of any findings. So when you get a replication, it's huge. I showed in two separate studies of mindfulness for people with chronic pain, and now in a third data set, the analgesic effects of mindfulness for people with chronic pain are statistically mediated by the capacity to reinterpret pain as harmless sensory information.
Right.
So we ask people questions like, to what extent do you view your pain not as pain, but rather as sensations of warmth or numbness? People report being better able to do that after getting 8 weeks of training with mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement. They also report being better able to do that with MBSR too. And the extent that people are able to do this, to be able to see their pain not as pain, but rather as pure sensation, that explains the degree of pain relief achieved by mindfulness. So there's data to support what you're talking about.
I surmise there is some quality of lessening the ego attachment to this is happening to me. It's not happening to anyone else. The entire ego structural story of this is all I am and this is happening to me falls away, because in the face of phenomena that come and go, internal or external, and the equalization, quote unquote, we'll use that word, of it internally and phenomenologically creates, I think, what in the text is called equanimity, this sense of equalness.
So some of the most exciting work we're doing right now is looking at the role that self-transcendence or non-dual awareness plays. We published a paper last year in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology showing that mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement increases self-transcendence. So increases experiences of the dissolution of the ego or the oneness of the self and the world. And that increases in these types of mystical experiences predict pain relief in people with chronic pain. And we have data that's brand new, that's not yet published, from two different studies. One is the largest study of Moore ever conducted that is finishing up. And the other is actually not even Moore. It's just a simple mindful breathing intervention showing the same thing, that when people participate in mindfulness-based interventions, some of them have the ability to transcend their ego, to have a sense of unity with the world. And those experiences have a very important clinical consequences. They predict the degree of pain relief that the person is going to achieve. My colleague Adam Hanley and I, we joke around with each other, no self, no pain.
I think I might say no self narrative. This is the misunderstanding, possibly, that some of the people you mentioned earlier might have had with you adding attention to pleasure. The experience of basic pain is part of life. It's what we make of that experience, the meaning of it, upset around it. This is the pain that you and I are talking about right now, not right. The fact that there may be some painful stimuli occurring, which is merely painful stimuli.
Right. Distinctions between nociception and pain and suffering. There's certainly no life without nociception. Nociception is what makes us move. I mean, that's life. Maybe there's life without suffering, although I think the Buddha said not that either. So
he says all phenomenal experience has a quality of unsatisfactoriness about it. He really didn't say anything about suffering. That is a poor mistranslation. We want a good experience to continue, and we want bad experience to end. And there is no such thing in a human life as either of those things. Therefore, all phenomenal experience has some quality of unsatisfactoriness. We'll never fully be satisfied.
Okay.
The poison is the medicine, right? Because the inevitable variation and variability of experience is exactly what makes us able to be in experience. We attend to the coming and going, the variability, the impermanence. This is the liberation. So the poison is the medicine.
I was on this mindful savoring tip for about 10 years, and I still am. But only recently did I realize that mindfulness of pain could actually be a pathway to experience bliss and the bliss of self-transcendence in the same way that mindfulness of pleasure could be the same pathway. Hadn't really been touched by the mindfulness research field.
No, but that's because there is a difference between mindfulness delivered clinically and the wisdom teachings. They are not the same thing.
Right.
There's many things maybe you and I have done in our practices that we would never offer someone in a clinical situation.
Or maybe we would, but nobody's been brave enough to research it yet. It made sense for the mindfulness field to very narrowly define and delimit the definition of mindfulness. You know, I was a part of that. I was involved in the field at just where it started blasting off. I was right there. And so along with people like Sarah Bowen and Fatal Zaidan and Dave Vago, we were all pretty lucky to be there at that moment and to have great mentors and teachers like Jon Kabat-Zinn and Linda Carlson and Richie Davidson. We were there to define the field in these terms that allowed this whole generation of federally funded science to emerge. A lot of us have really pushed that into the acceptance of mindfulness all the way up the chain into NIH to me being appointed on the NIH HEAL committee as the mindfulness guy, helping to oversee the nation's $1 billion initiative to develop solutions to the opioid crisis. They put me on there, this crazy guy talking about primordial bliss of consciousness. They put me on that committee. The reason why is because we narrowly defined mindfulness and we couched it in the terms of cognitive science. And it was a great move that our mentors guided us to do. We carried out the mission, so to speak. And I think it really has had a big benefit to society. The only problem with it is by defining mindfulness so narrowly, we've missed this whole other domain of practices that have a lot of potential therapeutic power, practices that can illuminate mysteries of human consciousness that science has yet to uncover. Plenty of work to do in the next wave.
I agree. I actually think it's good to let go of the definition. I never thought it was a good definition anyway.
Nice.
I mean, non-judgmental to me is the dumbest word I've ever heard. It just, to me, it just does not have anything to do with the practice.
What about the concept of right action and right speech and right effort? If there's a right, it means there's a wrong. That didn't compute too well.
I can only offer you this. One, what you just spoke is the fourth noble truth, which in the Soto Zen tradition that John studied in, you know, it didn't figure very much. This is a different tradition. It's the Chan Buddhist tradition out of China, which is much more in line actually with where you're going, the non-dual.
Yeah, definitely.
The primordial bliss.
Right.
The subtle body activation. I could say that I understand why none of that figured in that original definition. It makes sense to me.
Definitely. And it makes sense. We've taken all these influences and it's brought us to where we need to be.
I have no idea whether you want to talk about this. I am a trauma therapist. This is my specialty.
I didn't know that.
And I'm also a somatic experiencing practitioner. One of the things that everybody is talking about, when you offer these things to patients, sometimes they will have quote unquote adverse effects. Because you've been offering more to chronic pain patients who often, frankly, have trauma histories. Medical trauma, they have childhood trauma. It goes hand in hand.
For the past 10 years, we've been doing research with people with chronic pain who are prescribed opioids, misusing opioids. Many of them are from a low SES and have led really hard lives. The rates of comorbid psychiatric conditions, including PTSD, are really high.
So that is why I would like to ask you, what is your experience of how people who already have traumatic histories on board and co-occurring disorders, what's your experience of how they receive the practices, whether or not you're finding quote unquote adverse effects?
Our experience is that they receive the practices very well. They're benefiting across a range of clinical outcomes, both chronic pain-related outcomes, opioid misuse-related outcomes, and psychological health. They're improving as a result of contemplative practices. Adverse events, we're required by the federal government to record adverse events in our trials. We don't have reports of adverse events from meditation practice. We also carefully, within every session, as soon as the meditation is done, we are carefully debriefing that experience. We ask patients, what did you like best? And we ask them, what was challenging about that? So there's plenty of opportunity for people to talk about adverse events. You know, we just don't hear about people having trauma flashbacks or decompensating during meditation. Quite frankly, I think one reason why is because I have trained clinicians teaching mindfulness.
Right.
I don't have paraprofessionals leading mindfulness practice. And I think that's really important, quite frankly. All of our therapists are licensed therapists. For the main trials, they're all licensed. And so I think it makes a big difference if you have a well-trained clinician delivering the techniques. And then the other thing that I think makes a difference is skillfully titrating the person's practice to their experience, so that you really need to modulate arousal in a skillful way to help somebody have a really fruitful experience. And so, you know, there's a lot of complexity that goes into how you actually teach mindfulness in a way to be most clinically impactful while reducing any potential ill effects. I spend a lot of time teaching therapists how to do mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement. And so I spend a lot of time teaching them how to deliver mindfulness in an effective way, and then also how to debrief the experience, the practice of mindfulness, in a way that maximizes the learning and improves positive effects. I think all that plays into why we're not seeing adverse events. I'm aware of that kind of that undercurrent, people are talking about it, but I still haven't seen any convincing data on adverse events in relation to mindfulness practice. I could be missing a paper, but I haven't seen anything published anywhere of note with any convincing data. My read on it is it sounds like most of the stuff is coming out of reports from people on long-term meditation retreats.
Right.
That's quite different than mindfulness being delivered by a trained clinician in a clinical setting.
The definition to me is so broad of what is adverse. All those big pleasurable experiences you're talking about are included under the adverse list.
They are?
Yes, they are.
Really? That's adverse?
Yes. Kundalini flowing up the spine, not being able to handle the energy. Yes, that's all included in the adverse meditative experience list. Nobody's right. Talking to anybody, so it happens.
But not waves of blissful energy coursing through the body that of lesser intensity.
Well, this is the point, because every psyche is different. If you're someone who has a very low tolerance for activation in the autonomic nervous system in general, any activation, even a beautiful sunset, could send you over the edge.
One of the things we focus on in mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement is getting people to talk about their meditative experience in a very fine-grained, phenomenological way. And then we help them to walk through that experience and to understand it. Not only do we give them education about what's happening to them, we also give them a ton of positive reinforcement around what's happening to them.
I haven't been trained in more, but it sounds so akin to everything I've been offering to my patients for so many years. I'm overjoyed.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you said that. I think a lot of good modern therapists must practice this way. It really is sort of the unification of mindfulness with third wave cognitive behavioral therapy and principles from positive psychology into a codified kind of package. But people had not kind of put it into a manualized protocol before. And so that's what I did.
Are you finding Utah is a different place to offer this intervention, or are people receiving it in the same way that they received it in Florida?
I don't see any difference in how people respond to it here. I was curious about that, about how people in LDS culture would respond to mindfulness practices. But in my experience, folks here are really pretty open to it, no different than anywhere else. Could be that I'm seeing a biased sample. The people who choose to come see me, they know what I do.
Some of your research has a really interesting term, the term hedonic dysregulation.
Yeah.
Would you describe hedonic dysregulation?
Hedonic dysregulation is this umbrella term that I use to describe a cluster of effects that happen as a person becomes entrenched in the downward spiral, linking chronic pain to opioid misuse and addiction. Their brain becomes hypersensitized to stress, pain, and drug-related cues, and at the same time becomes insensitive to the pleasure derived from naturally rewarding objects and events in the social environment. There's one other sort of facet to this hedonic dysregulation process, which is not only is there the changing of the brain's responsivity to stress, pain, and drug-related cues, as well as natural pleasure, there's another process which happens that interferes with top-down regulation of emotional responding. So the person becomes less able to effectively self-regulate their emotional response. So it's kind of the double whammy. They're becoming more reactive to negative stimuli, if you will, and they're becoming more insensitive to positive stimuli. And then they're becoming less able to regulate their responses to those stimuli. as the cycle of hedonic dysregulation grows over time, the person has trouble regulating their negative emotions. So they're less able to decrease their negative emotions, and they have trouble upregulating their positive emotions. And I've shown with respect to chronic pain and opioid misuse, that opioid misusers have blunted capacity to regulate negative and positive emotions compared to chronic pain patients who take opioids as prescribed by their doctors. Right. So opioid, it seems to be something pretty specific about opioid misuse is linked with this inability to regulate hedonic responses.
Would you say that in your research, you've charted whether or not trauma history has anything to do with who would end up being someone who would misuse as opposed to people who would just use their opioids as prescribed?
I published a paper last year in the Journal of Development and Psychopathology showing that higher numbers of adverse childhood experiences predict heightened opioid craving in response to negative emotions. This was in a sample. Everybody had pain. Everybody was prescribed opioids. But the people who had the most extensive childhood trauma histories, when we stressed them out in the laboratory, they craved their opioids even more.
Yeah.
And I have some new data that we're working on right now for publication, which is really pretty cool. In this study, we showed people opioid images and we asked them to rate their craving, looked at their baseline characteristics, and we wanted to answer the question, what's a stronger predictor of opioid craving? Physical pain or emotional pain? And I think you know the answer to this question. Turns out that psychiatric distress, emotional distress, is a significantly stronger predictor of opioid craving than physical pain among people with chronic pain who are prescribed opioids for their pain. As you know, pain is multifactorial, and emotional pain is a really powerful source of pain.
Absolutely. Well, how interesting. It's wonderful that you've done that research.
I'm definitely interested in trauma too, and we're starting to explore it in earnest. The data from mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement also seems to show that therapy reduces trauma symptoms in addition to all this other stuff.
Trauma symptoms, you mean the psychological traumas?
Yeah, so it not only does more decrease chronic pain severity and opioid misuse, but it also decreases PTSD symptoms as well.
I have one more question. Would you describe the difference between savoring and craving?
Well, you saved the easy question for last, huh?
We've talked so much about both of these things, and I thought, okay.
I once asked Matthieu Ricard, and for your listeners who don't know who Matthieu is, he's a world-renowned Buddhist meditation master, spent a lot of time with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, is also intimately involved in the Mind and Life Institute, and is a great contemplative mind. I asked him, I said, Matthieu, is it possible to savor positive experience without being attached to it? Is it possible to do it without attachment? And he said, yes, all you have to do is just focus on it without attachment. And then it's savoring without attachment. And I said, yeah, thank you. You can focus attention, positive experience. And the essence really of savoring is not necessarily the exteroceptive attention. So it's not necessarily just focusing on what is pleasing about the object, but also there's this dual motion where metacognitive awareness is engaged so that you're at the simultaneously, you're also becoming aware of your own emotional and physiological response to the pleasurable event. And then you turn attention inward and you savor the inner bliss. That's really where the meat of it is. You can do that without clinging to it. There doesn't have to be this notion that it's going to be continued forever. There doesn't have to be a sense that you need it. So the difference is really being fully open to the beauty of that moment, because that moment is the only thing that exists. That's different than craving, because craving is both future and past oriented. Either you're wanting something that's not there, or then you're missing something that was.
Yes, it's both assumptive and expectational rather than actual. The nature of unsatisfactoriness is our inability to do accurate predicting.
But savoring, it's actually really appreciating the satisfactoriness of whatever that experience is in the moment.
Or appreciating the satisfactoriness of unsatisfactoriness. That quality of, yes, this is beautiful, not because I'm getting what I want. It's beautiful because this is the truth of existence. And truth is what liberates us and our patients. So when they have the efficacy to have experience of what's true, actually true. I just find the power of that kind of capacity, that natural innate capacity, is liberating and empowering. And it's much better than anything we could offer them in terms of making them feel better or self-esteem or any of that crap, which is so beside the point, frankly.
I don't want to frame myself like that, although I do believe in an absolute truth. And I certainly don't believe in the concept of, quote, seeing things as they are. I think that's total nonsense, unless we're going to talk about the absolute seeing things as they are. Becoming satisfied with the unsatisfactory, savoring as it gets more and more advanced and more refined. You know, we start with the gross positive events, because those are really easy to savor. If you look at some of the writings of Tsongkhapa, he clearly states, if you want the good, stable base of shamatha, focus on pleasant experience because it captivates you. But as it gets more and more refined, I think, you know, then as we talked about, you can begin to savor unpleasant experience. And then you're coming down to just savoring the sense of existence.
So that would be the truth that I'm pointing at. Duality of existence. So all along our conversation today, you basically have been sharing that more allows patients to have more of what is actually occurring for them.
Of what we can speak, I would only speak that, you know, of what is occurring is existence, is being, or as you said, Satchit Ananda.
This is true, except often people experience that quality in an experience that is not directly beingness. It's not that they are having the direct experience of beingness. It may just be that they are in the truth, as you earlier stated, of what their sensations really are, what their pain really is. That to me is the liberating truth. Oh, wow. I thought my pain was this, but actually here it is. This, just this bunch of things that come and go. That's the truth I'm talking about, that I feel like you've been talking about through our entire conversation today. Nothing more than that.
Nothing more than that. From a clinical perspective, we're speaking the same language.
Are you at all thinking of creating a model of more individual therapists could do with a patient?
We're actually part of a research group that's studying an individual version of more for chronic pain. So that's actually being actively studied, well, it was before COVID-19. We had already begun to study that in two really huge randomized clinical trials. I think that mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement can be used in an individual format.
So will you create a standardized manual for that?
I think we will create a manual for that. The next manual that's got to go out is the opioid pain version of the treatment that has been tested so well.
If clinicians want to train in more, how do they do that? Where do they go?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. They should just reach out and contact me. I have a website, drericgarland.com. They can find information there and send me an email, and I can give them training information. I typically hold a couple of trainings a year, probably about two, gathering together clinicians, social workers, psychologists, nurses, physicians from around the country and do a training. It's a two-day training for people who already have some basis in understanding of mindfulness and clinical work. I also sometimes go to agencies as well. So if there's a healthcare organization or a medical facility that wants to train a bunch of staff, I can go out there and train them as well. I love training and teaching. It's a real joy.
We're coming to the end of our time. Anything else we haven't talked about?
I think that was a nice interview. I think that captures it.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it tremendously. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Thanks for the great questions. It was a fun dialogue.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To get in touch, please visit brownlessground.com. Let's dedicate our efforts to the healing of our planet and all its inhabitants. See you next time on the Groundless Ground.